Welcome to today's program titled FCC Privacy Rules, Part 2, Opt-ins and Opt-outs, The New Regime. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen, then type and send your question that way. At the end of today's event, a link to an online evaluation will be displayed on your screen. Please take a few moments to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. I would now like to introduce our host for today's call, Alex Reynolds. Welcome, Alex. You may begin.
Hopefully they can. So in part one, we went over the data security and data breach obligations for telecommunications carriers under the new rules. In part two, what we're going to do is talk about some of the other core rules that the FCC adopted, the notice and choice rules, and also go over a number of challenges or risks to those rules that are legal, procedural in nature. So to recap, the FCC adopted its new privacy rules on October 27th. They create new obligations for telecommunications carriers, which include broadband internet access service providers, such as ISPs, but also interconnected VoIP providers and voice telephony providers. And they differ in key respects from the Federal Trade Commission's regime, and in fact other regimes, state and federal, in key ways. And we'll be going over more of the ways in which they differ here. So to recap our agenda, we're going to go over a timeline for implementation, since we now have a date of Federal Register publication to which we can peg some of the rule timelines. We'll talk about the legal challenges, the notice and choice rules and their substantive portions and effect. We'll go over the prohibition on conditional offers for service and the enhanced notice where a carrier provides a financial incentive. And then finally, some recommendations given a lot of the uncertainty that surrounds the rules. So as you may know, the rules were published in the Federal Register on December 2nd, last Friday. So we know a couple of the implementation deadlines. The foundational rules, the background, the conditional offer prohibition, business customer exemption, will all go into effect on January 3rd. The 30-day timeline ends January 1st, but of course there are federal holidays, so it gets pushed to January 3rd. And then the data security requirements, which we discussed in the last webinar, will take effect 90 days from publication, which is March 2nd. But there are still a number of uncertain deadlines here, and that's because several of the key rules are pegged to the date of OMB approval under the Paperwork Reduction Act. So what we do know for breach notification is that it won't go into effect any earlier than June 2nd, 2017, because there has to be at least 6 months for implementation deadline, but it could go into effect later than that. Similarly, with the notice and choice rules that we'll be primarily discussing today, those won't go into effect any earlier than December 2nd, 2017, and then for small carriers, there will be a one-year extension to December 2018, but again, that timeline is a little bit up in the air. And we try to visualize this for you in this slide. Timeline one simply describes the hard deadlines that we have for the foundational and the data security rules. And then timeline two attempts to show the process that the rule will have to go through, or certain portions of the rule will have to go through before they, one, become effective, and then two, the FCC creates a compliance deadline. In the implementation paragraphs of the rule, the FCC directs the Wireline Competition Bureau to issue a public notice that gives carriers a minimum of 8 weeks to comply with the rule that will have already been approved under the Paperwork Reduction Act process. So even if, or even when there's a Federal Register publication for that notes that OMB has completed its PRA approval process, there will still be a time frame before compliance is in effect. So keep your eyes glued to the Federal Register. So let's talk about some risks to the rule, some potential legal challenges that we anticipate could potentially happen. First are petitions for reconsideration and court challenges. As you may know, in the FCC itself, sua sponte, or an interested party can bring a petition for reconsideration, and that deadline is the 30 days after publication in the Federal Register, which would be January 3rd. A party could choose to bring a petition for reconsideration, or it can bring a petition for review, which is a court challenge. The court challenge deadline is January 31st, 2017, because that's a 60-day deadline. We note, however, that if a carrier or if a interested party wishes to participate in the judicial lottery process, which governs the circuit court selection when two or more parties challenge a rule, that party has to file by December 12th because there's a 10-day deadline. And for those of you keeping score, that's in 28 USC 2112 and then Commission Rule 1.13, if you'd like to go read those. So again, a party has to choose either between filing a petition for reconsideration or filing that court challenge. They could be done sequentially, but they can't be done simultaneously. Now, because some rules, some core rules, require OMB approval through the Paperwork Reduction Act process, the Trump administration, which has evidenced a desire not to have any new regulation, could put pressure on OMB to potentially deny the Paperwork Reduction Act approval component of these rules and thereby halt their implementation. We note that in the rules, OMB is required to complete its review within 60 days of receipt of the rule or its publication in the Federal Register, whichever is later. But we have noted instances in OMB's approval of FCC rules in other rulemakings that OMB has taken quite some time to finally publish approval. So there's a great deal of uncertainty, if you think back to the timeline of the previous slide, about when the notice choice and breach rules may actually come into effect. Of course, congressional action is always possible. Legislation clearly would be able to roll back the rules or make some other modifications to them. But there's also the Congressional Review Act and the Joint Resolution of Disapproval Procedure. The deadline for introducing a joint resolution is 60 days from the date of receipt of that report that's required from the FCC to Congress publishing its rule. And we say it's 60 days of continuous session because there's a tolling provision in that statute where the days are only counted if Congress is in session continuously for more than 3 days. Finally, the FCC itself can take certain actions, and under a potentially Republican-led FCC, may in fact take these actions of nullifying the privacy rules themselves. Another rulemaking that would modify the privacy rules, or reversing the open internet order and broadband reclassification, so taking broadband back to an information service, which would take it out of Title II and therefore out of the purview of Section 222 on which these privacy rules are based. It is possible to do one without the other. We won't opine on the likelihood of this happening, but it's possible that the privacy rules are modified, but the open internet order is left intact, which would still create obligations for ISPs. Or if the open internet order is reversed, but the privacy rules are left unmodified, then basically they would only apply to voice services because broadband providers would be taken out of Section 222, as I just mentioned. Or, of course, the FCC could choose not to enforce. The rules create obligations that would have to be enforced by the Enforcement Bureau, and they could be left intact, and the FCC could simply choose not to take any action. So, again, just trying to visualize the timeline of these potential challenges. 10 days for the judicial lottery, 30 for petitions for reconsideration, 60 days for a court challenge, and then the separate process of the Congressional Review Act and disapproval. By the way, a copy of the slides will be made available, so no need to take pictures of your screen or copy this down quickly. So there are certain challenges to the structure of these rules and some logistical issues, you know, aside from the challenges that we have already in terms of legal challenges. As long as ISPs are classified as telecom carriers, Section 222 itself is going to continue to apply to them. And as we mentioned in part one of our webinar, the FCC clearly has taken some enforcement action under Section 222 itself to uphold that aspect of the statute. Similarly, the new rules are going to completely replace the CP&I rules, and we'll discuss that a little bit more on the next slide. Basically, as the rules are phased in, it could create some technical complications because the FCC has said in its implementation clause, that the current CP&I rules will continue to apply to voice providers. Finally, there's a state law preemption issue. New section 64.2012 of the rules talks about state law preemption explicitly and notes that preemption will only occur to the extent that the rules conflict with state law. So the FCC will be analyzing that on a case-by-case basis. So let's look a little bit more closely at the old rule to new rule transition here. In paragraph 310, which I just mentioned, the FCC says that its current implementing rules are going to apply basically to voice, not to bias or interconnected VoIP providers. And the chart that we have here compares the sections of the old rules to the new rules to try to give you a visualization of what happens. Certain rules, like 64.2001, will be replaced effective January 3rd. They go into effect 30 days from publication in the Federal Register, and so that will happen. But if you look at the definition section, there are two different definition sections. One is 2002 in the new rule column on the right, and another one is .2003 in the old rules on the left. And what you'll notice is that while the definitions in the new rules go into effect on January 3rd, the old rules still stay in effect, at least for voice services. So there are two definition sections and potentially conflicting definitions that apply to these sets of rules. Similarly, you could see at the bottom of that table in 64.2011 that in the old rules that dealt with breach notification requirements for CPNI, but in the new rules, there's a Part A and a Part B, one of which goes into effect on January 3rd, and then another which goes into effect in an indeterminate period of time after OMB PRA approval. So at least for voice services, to a certain extent, the rules will theoretically overlap. We don't want to spend too much time on this because, of course, it seems that the intent of the FCC is to keep the old rules intact for voice services, but we note that if there were a judicial challenge, for example, or something like that where the technicalities matter, this could be a potential hurdle.
And Alex, we do expect we hope that somebody will file a petition for reconsideration so that the FCC can better align the new rules and the old rules as they phase in and out.
Great. So with that, I will turn it over to Kristen McNeely for a discussion of the substantive notice and choice rules.
Thanks, Alex, and thanks everybody for joining us today, because honestly, there was a lot of debate as to whether we should even have this second part of the series, given all of the uncertainty around the rules. And you may be asking yourselves, why am I sitting here listening to this? And hopefully it is because nothing is ever certain. And so while we certainly anticipate that there will either be congressional review or that there may be an FCC action under new administration, either to in response to petitions for reconsideration, or potentially even a new rulemaking, depending on what happens with the Congressional Review Act. Some of this may stay, and actually some of it may not be addressed at all. We've heard from some constituents that they actually like the voice rules better. So there may be a push to keep these new rules in place if reclassification is going to take effect and internet services will actually go back to be an information service versus a Title II telecommunications service. And as we go through the notice and choice provisions, I think you will see, especially on the notice provisions, and as we talked about last week with the breach notification, the rules in some ways actually are better than the existing voice rules, in some respects. And what makes these rules so untenable and so controversial is the fact that when you look at internet services outside of traditional voice phone services, the difference between the way the FTC framework operated and the way information was protected and the true sensitivity based framework that did not include web browsing history or application usage history, that is what makes the rules so different for ISPs. But when you take all of that away, the rules actually do become more reasonable for voice services. So let's talk a little bit about that. So as you can see on the notice slide, we're going to compare a little bit about what the old requirements are and what the new requirements are. And of course, both of them have the basic requirement that you have to notify customers of your privacy policies and the customer choices. Remember, under the old, this only was with respect to traditional CPNI that related to the voice services. Whereas now, under the new rules, it includes CPI, the customer proprietary information, which we'll go into detail about exactly what that includes on the next slide. The format of the rules, this is one of the places where while the new rules are broader, it actually is a little bit more reasonable. The old rules, similar to the new rules, required you to provide sufficient information to enable the customers to make the choices that you're going to give them with respect to the use of their information. But it also required you to disclose some very specific language and also the specific entities that were going to have access to CPNI. If you think about that in the world of the Internet, there are so many players in the Internet ecosystem that it would be very difficult to list all of those specific entities, and you would also be changing it on a constant basis, especially in light of this broad definition of what customer proprietary information is. If you had to think about everybody that you share an IP address with, or just other information that makes the Internet work, it's not really reasonable. So instead, what the commission said is that there has to be this clear, conspicuous, comprehensible, and not misleading privacy policy that's very consistent with the advice and the guidance that the Federal Trade Commission has provided. And then as far as content goes, you have to talk about the types of CPI that you collect and when you're going to disclose it. And instead of the specific entities to which that information is disclosed, you just have to put the categories of entities to whom that information is disclosed, which a lot of internet, broadband internet privacy policies today already do all of these things. The rights that the customer has with respect to making choices about how their information is used and how they can, if the customer provides approval, how the customer can change their mind later on. And important, as you interact with customers, if you provide bills, for instance, in Spanish language, or if you have Spanish language call centers, you will also have to provide your privacy notices in the Spanish language as well. One thing that we don't really get into here but should also be considered, and I am by no means an expert on the accessibility rules, but we are already seeing a lot of questions with respect to how the accessibility rules apply, and these should be considered in your programs if you have websites that have accessibility requirements. The privacy notices should be one of those pages that is also accessible. The timing of the notices and the old notices, you had to, for all of the opt-out choices that you had to put this privacy notice out there 30 days in advance, and you couldn't effectuate any choices until after that waiting period was finalized. And then you would have follow-up notices to the customers every 2 years. Now this has to be provided at a point of sale through a website or an app, or a functional equivalent. And the commission stated that when they start talking about functional equivalents, it's really to think about forward-looking technologies that they can't anticipate yet. As well as any time that you're going to make a material change to the to your privacy practices, you actually have to provide advance notice at that point, and it has to be via a direct communication. So however the customer elects to communicate with you, there has to be a direct notice to that customer to make sure that they see what changes there are going to be with respect to the use of their CPNI and other customer proprietary information. One of the other things that changed was under the record keeping requirements. The old rules actually required that the carriers maintain, or the covered entities maintain, records of both the notification as well as the consent for at least 1 year. Those record keeping requirements have gone away under the new rules. So that all seems more reasonable if you compare what was in place before and what wasn't. This is the part that makes it so much more difficult, is when we look at choice, or even how you provide notifications, you have to look at all of the information that you have to tell customers about under these new rules and the choices and what types of information are affected here. So customer proprietary information, again, is CPNI plus, which is customer proprietary network information, plus personally identifiable information, plus the content of communications. And just to recap, CPNI, you have voice CPNI, which is everything that CPNI has always been, which does not include subscriber list information, which are names and addresses, basically directory information, phone numbers. But remember, the commission said in this new order that subscriber list information has no meaning here because there aren't published directories for the internet. And therefore, name and address becomes CPNI and phone number or IP address, whatever it is. It becomes CPNI in the broadband context. And PII can also, as the slide shows in its little Venn diagram, you can have information that is both CPNI as well as PII, and you can even have information that is sensitive CPNI and PII under the commission's very broad reading of what this category of information includes. Content of communications, just a note on content of communications, they are sensitive, but while not specifically addressed, there will be communications that a customer makes with its ISP directly, where the ISP is a party to that communication. In that instance, arguably, that is not sensitive customer proprietary information because the ISP is a first party. What the commission is trying to get at here is that the ISP should not be going into its customers' emails with third parties simply because it has access. Instead, that information is sensitive, and it's between your customer and a third party. So just trying to make some distinctions there. The other information that is sensitive in addition to content, we talked about this a little bit last time, but you know, the historically sensitive information under Federal Trade Commission guidance, financial, health, children's information, social security numbers, and precise geolocation. The call detail information, still sensitive. It was CPNI under the voice rules. And then also now this is, again, the more controversial aspects of this, but the web browsing, the app usage, and the functional equivalent of those things. Under the Federal Trade Commission regime, that information in and of itself was not sensitive. Instead, if an ISP pulled information from its domain name server and you were looking at a website, Food Network, I'll just go ahead and admit that I go to foodnetwork.com, so now it's no longer sensitive. But under the FCC's rules, that type of information would have been sensitive. Under the FTC framework, you could use that information to market to that user on an opt-out basis. You could not use the fact that, and this is totally fictional, but if I went to cancertreatment.com, that information, however, because it relates to a health condition, that would be considered sensitive. And that's the way that all of the other entities within the internet ecosystem kind of apply the sensitivity-based framework that the FTC has put in place. And that is the big difference between what the Federal Trade Commission has historically done and now the FCC has said it doesn't matter whether it's foodnetwork.com or cancertreatmentnetwork.com, it's all sensitive because it reveals a lot about a user and they should be able to control that information on an opt-in basis. Which is where we are here with choice. So looking at the different types of information and the different ways that an ISP can use that information, there are still the statutory exceptions under Section 222 that the FCC said, of course, we recognize that Congress intended for certain information to be used without a customer providing any consent. Just the fact that they have subscribed to the service implies their consent for the ISP to be able to do things like initiate, render, bill, and collect service. The language of the order, the FCC was actually, they did actually give a little bit on this area. They talked about things like network management, conducting research to improve and protect the ISP's network would fall under this initiate, render, bill, and collect exception. Similarly, the internal analysis that a lot of ISPs do in order to develop and improve their products, they said that this falls under the statutory exceptions. They also said things like if there was some other law that allowed you to do this, for instance, law enforcement disclosures or disclosures to the government for emergency situations, that would also be permitted under the new rules without a consumer's consent. The first party marketing, though, so this kind of bleeds into the opt-out consent and the requirements there. They do allow limited first-party marketing, and they've actually expanded it a little bit from the old rules. So now within first-party marketing, without any consent from the consumers, an ISP can market communication services that are commonly bundled together with the subscriber's telecom service. So what that really brings in is likely to be video services. So historically, you will have bundles of phone, broadband service, and video service, and the commission said you can market those. They also specifically excluded home automation services or home security services from these communication services that are commonly bundled. So where a lot of ISPs are now offering those types of services, they are now subject to opt-out consent. The commission's reasoning for this was they refer to other rules such as do not call or the can spam requirements. And they said, ISPs already have these programs in place and consumers can already go to them and say, I don't want you to contact me with your own marketing under the do not call rules or under the can spam rules. And having been in FCC meetings, a lot of times, the ISP's argument back was these rules already exist. You don't need to do more. But here, this covers, it's actually difficult to know what all this covers. Can a customer say, don't put that advertisement on my bill? Don't advertise for your services. Don't send me direct mail. I think definitely direct mail. You would be using CP&I information to do that. So you need to start thinking, ISPs need to start thinking about what are the ways that we contact customers and where would we need to provide those choices. Similarly, opt-in consent is going to be required for any use of sensitive customer proprietary information. And if you make a change that is material and retroactive, so if you've collected information in one context and you haven't disclosed that you're going to use this type of, whether it's sensitive or not, if you're going to use information for a new purpose that you have not previously disclosed, then you have to get opt-in consent. This is really important when an ISP is making changes to its privacy policies. To think about, and this actually is an existing rule, so I don't want people on the phone to think, oh, this is some new horrible thing. This is actually consistent with the Federal Trade Commission's existing guidance and some enforcement actions over at the Federal Trade Commission. So if you have information that you have collected from a customer and you're going to use that information that's already in your databases for some new purpose that you haven't already disclosed, it's opt-in, and it should be treated that way today. So the choice examples, we just wanted to give some actual examples of ways that information might be collected and what requirements it would be subjected to. So we've talked about name and address, and how you might get this information from your retail store, for instance, or just when somebody signs up for service on your website. As soon as it, which goes actually something we haven't talked about is what is a customer. So a customer is somebody that applies for service. They don't even have to be connected in receiving service yet, but as soon as they submit that application. And maybe they never become connected, but once they apply, you will have access to certain name, address, and other information. But you might actually, for background checks, for instance, have Social Security numbers. So the commission wanted all of that information to be covered. Once somebody's actually receiving and paying for service, they're a customer and subject to these rules. But the commission also included former customers. So to the extent that you have any information on customers after the fact, and that could also get interesting depending on what happens with these rules, but how do you maintain opt-in and opt-out programs for former customers? Maybe it's something that we'll never have to deal with. But let's say that you get a name and address. That is personally identifiable information. We've always considered it to be personally identifiable information. It is also now broadband CPNI, whereas under the phone rules, it was not considered to be CPNI. It is not sensitive information in and of itself, but it is subject to opt-out consent in order for you to use that beyond those that limited set of exceptions under Section 222. IP addresses, you know, this is another type of address, something I argue should have been considered subscriber list information in the broadband context, but the commission did not care what I had to say about it. And so it is now considered to be PII, and it is also considered to be broadband CPNI. That, you know, obviously you capture IP addresses all the time. You just have to think about the context in which you are using that information. If you're only using it to route traffic, to provide service, billing, whatever it is, that's not going to be subject to choice. But to the extent that you are collecting IP addresses from your network, that is then subject to these rules and subject to opt-out consent. Unless you are tying that to something like a URL, which is considered content, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, and is therefore sensitive information, then that is going to be considered opt-in. But generally, IP address in and of itself is considered PII, broadband CPNI, and it's subject to opt-out requirements. We should also note that while hopefully you caught it when I said if you get this from your network, this information is all over the internet ecosystem. There are cookies dropping on almost every website that you visit. You can go to a variety of data aggregators, marketing companies, ad networks who not only have the IP address, but they have these profiles built of people who, might be a female between a certain age who goes to Food Network and also lives in Washington, D.C., and all kinds of other information about me that you can then purchase. So that was one of the big criticisms of this order is it proposes that the FCC has touted that this order creates greater privacy for consumers on the internet, but it really doesn't because all of this information still exists in other contexts and you are able to just go out and purchase it essentially. But in the meantime, it's putting ISPs at a competitive disadvantage. The precise geolocation information, it is and has been considered to be sensitive information under the Federal Trade Commission framework. The FCC still considers it to be sensitive and would be subject to opt-in. The websites visited, however, again, you don't need to spend a lot of time on it, but historically it has not been considered sensitive. Now it is sensitive, again, subject to those rules. The other thing that I just want to spend 1 minute on is none of this applies, and we talked about this last week, but none of this applies if information is de-identified. It is unclear under the order, and the order actually indicates that an ISP cannot de-identify IP addresses because they are always going to know who owns the IP address. Now, an ISP could potentially hash an IP address, apply a one-way hash, and put controls in place and commit to not re-identify the information. But if an ISP ever wants to use an IP address that they got off of their network to target some sort of messaging back to the device at the end of that IP address, then it is always going to be considered to be PII. The other thing that the commission did in this order was they said ISPs cannot make broadband service, the receipt of broadband service, contingent on a customer's waiver of its privacy rights. This is what was referred to in the NPRM and the order as a take it or leave it offer that is prohibited. You cannot say, if you want my service, you have to allow me to use your information in these ways. Oftentimes that was done, and if you think about edge providers where you have a free service but you have to agree to terms and conditions, and the terms and conditions may say that we're going to use your information in certain ways. Gmail is a good example of that. I have a Gmail account, and when I signed up for it, it's free. I had to agree to certain things, and now they can use my information for all of those purposes without getting additional consent. The FCC here said broadband service is too important, and it's a paid service, and ISPs cannot condition the receipt of that service on a customer's consent to using their information in any way that the ISP puts in their terms and conditions, their general terms and conditions or their general privacy policy. So this is actually consistent with concerns that the Federal Trade Commission had expressed in the past. And what the FCC said is, while you can't condition your service on this, you can provide financial incentives to compel a customer to provide consent. Now, you have to be careful, because the incentives, you know, there was a lot of concern about discrimination and the types of effects that this would have on low-income customers, for instance. So the incentives should not be prohibitive. I'm sure the commission said that they're going to look at these on a case-by-case basis. But if you said, I will give you broadband for $20, or if you grant consent, or I will charge you $100 if you don't, it almost becomes a take it or leave it type offer. I don't know if we'll get more guidance on that. We'll see if the rules actually go into effect, because these are the financial incentives are actually the requirements here are subject to OMB approval. The other thing, you know, they compared it to customer loyalty programs, but they said that if you're going to do this, there has to be clear and conspicuous notice at the time that you make the offer and when the customer accepts the offer. And that notice has to be separate. You can't bury it in your general terms and conditions or privacy policy, and you have to get an opt-in consent in order to be able to use this type of consent is subject to opt-in. A customer has to affirmatively say that they want to allow you to use their information in this way. So going back to the question of why have I listened to you for 45 minutes if it's so unclear whether these rules will go into effect. Again, you know, part of it is just understanding what the rules would require for your particular organization. If they apply to you, there is no guarantee that they are going to go away or that they are not going to go into effect or that some portion of them isn't going to go into effect. And even if the rules don't go into effect, there's likely to be another rulemaking that would impose these rules. Maybe they will go into effect just for the phone services. So what we advise, you know, looking at last week, the information security program that is not subject to OMB approval, you know, there's broad application there beyond just the FCC rules. The framework is very consistent with other agencies, and you know, it's a good idea, if you don't already have this in place, to get your written information security program, you know, get that documented and in place as soon as possible. On the notice and choice provisions, there are a lot of, you know, some of this actually is consistent with Federal Trade Commission advice. So where it's not a departure, you should do an assessment, and you should make sure you understand what the information is that you are collecting today, what consents you get for that, and that it is in compliance either with existing CP&I rules or with the Federal Trade Commission guidance. And you should think about it in terms of, okay, if these rules go into effect in a year, or if I'm a small operator in 2 years, what are the different types of CPI that we collect? How do we use it? What are the consents that we get today? And what are the consents I would need under the new rules? Once you go through that first part of the analysis, then you can determine what is it going to take for me to implement all of these changes if the rules go into effect, and you can create a transition plan. And by a transition plan, I mean a postpone plan. What is the latest date that I need to get, you know, to that I can wait until I need to get started on doing this if it looks like these rules are going to go into effect? And I think within the next, well, who knows, but within the next few months, we will have a better idea of what's going to happen at the commission, what Congress's priorities are going to be, because they have a lot of priorities. This is very important to my practice and to my clients and, you know, presumably to the people on the phone, but there are a lot of different agencies. As I watched the Federal Register over the last several weeks and waited for that notice, I couldn't believe all of the F agencies that there were between the FAA, the FDA, FERC, and then you get into all of the other agencies and that have been controversial, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There's a lot of threats to roll back things there. So we'll have to see how Congress prioritizes things as well and what the FCC does either with the petitions for reconsideration that are sure to be filed or some other rulemaking that they initiate on this matter. So with that, if there aren't any questions, I think we are at the end of our 50 minutes.
Right, so folks can feel free to ask questions through the webinar interface, or I think our operator can also open up the line if folks want to ask an oral question.
Yes, to ask a question via the web presentation again, please select the chat pod in the lower left corner of your screen, type your question, and click the send button. Or, as Alex mentioned, to ask a live question, you may press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Okay, we have no questions at this time. Excellent, thank you. A link to the online evaluation is now displayed on your screen. Please take a few minutes to complete it. We do appreciate your feedback. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.